Diane. Great to be back with you. On My Mind This Week, John Kerry has long been in the public eye as U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, as the 2004 Democratic presidential candidate, and most recently as Secretary of State under President Obama. Now, Kerry is out with a new memoir titled Every Day is Extra, a reflection on the many chapters of his life. But as he looks back, Kerry is keenly interested in our current political moment. He's criticized President Trump for undemocratic leadership, and he thinks the upcoming midterms are a chance to change the course of the country. John Kerry joined me by phone on Thursday afternoon. Secretary Kerry, it's good to have you with us again. It was 2009 when I last talked with you, so it's great to have you back.
Well, thank you very much. It's been too long, and I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. Talk about how we have reached this extraordinary place in our democracy. You've written this memoir about your own time in public life, but so much has changed. What's happened to us?
Well, what's happened is actually, I think, pretty definable and clear. For one thing, we've had a continuing increase in the amount of big money that is in American politics. And I think personally, it steals the voice of average citizens who don't have the opportunity to throw that kind of money around and whose interests are not necessarily being represented. That's number one. Number two, we've had a corruption of our own system by virtue of the gerrymandering that takes place. Both parties have done that on occasion, but it deprives the American electorate of a legitimate democratic election in the general elections, usually, and places a premium on primaries, which has been used as a weapon, certainly, on the political right. Thirdly, Washington has literally failed over some period of years now to respond to the real, broad, legitimate needs of Americans who feel displaced by globalism, who feel that trade has not been their friend, and whose wages are not going up while the wealthiest people in the country get wealthier. And I think there's an alienation of average voters from their government, which was manifested mostly recently by the succession of what happened with the Gingrich Revolution, then the Tea Party, then the Freedom Caucus, and now effectively a hostile takeover of the Republican Party by Donald Trump and a changing of the party. So all of this is a reaction to the felt needs of Americans not being responded to. And on the left during the last primary, you obviously had Bernie Sanders and a fight there. So when you add it all up, what you really have is dissatisfaction voicing itself with just, you know, tear it apart, pull it down, rather than honoring the time-proven tradition of bipartisanship, of partnership across party lines, like John McCain and I were able to do on one or two particular topics. And I think others have done historically. But that's what's put us where we are today, a growing anger and a growing sense of failure of Washington to respond to the needs of the American people.
I wonder what you think of the idea that whenever people with very negative ideas have been allowed to rise in political systems, that those who have felt disenfranchised then feel empowered to speak up and speak out in very, very negative ways.
No question about it. Historically, you've seen that all over the world. And I think that we've had our moments in this country when we've had difficulties. You can go back to the last century with the Red Scare. You can look at the period in Washington, the late 1960s, early 70s, with Richard Nixon, who, by the way, had an enemies list, attacked the Justice Department, politicized the Justice Department, fired Archie Cox, saw the resignation of Elliot Richardson, taped people and lied to the American people. And so, eventually that caught up to him, but our institutions were tested. And we went through a very difficult period in the United States when there were bombings, there were fires and riots, students shot at Kent State, but we got through it. I mean, the important message, Diane, is there's a basic resilience and optimism in America, and Americans are resilient and optimistic. And I believe our institutions, when tested, have proven themselves to be strong and capable of withstanding this. What's happened is there's a certain amount of demagoguery that's taking place right now. We're not making decisions based on facts. We're not even able to agree as a country what the basic facts are. So this is a moment of enormous challenge, but I'm convinced if real choices are put in front of people and people are determined to unite the country, not divide it, we have the ability to make the decisions if we will get back to honoring bipartisanship and reaching across the lines to find common ground.
Tell me what you made of the Kavanaugh confirmation.
It was a terrible process. I mean, like most Americans, I think everybody was really turned off by it. I mean, it just displayed a disregard for a woman's testimony, which was credible, very extremely credible. I mean, I believe that what she described happened to her. And I think that the way the committee wound up racing through a non-investigation and fundamentally avoiding a confrontation with facts has done a disservice to the committee, to the nominating process, and ultimately to the core values of our democracy.
And here's what worries me. When you say our institutions are working,
I said they're fundamentally strong. They aren't working. Congress is not working. And who knows what happens with the court now, but the executive is not working. The executive is throwing out, respect for facts. It doesn't do the fact-finding. The EPA passes laws, regulations based on complete phoniness. I mean, we're in a very dangerous period. It is a challenge to those institutions, but they're fundamentally strong, and I think ultimately will withstand it. But we're going to have to fight for that. Nothing's automatic, Diane, in a democracy. There's no automatic pilot to sustainability. People have to fight for it. Citizens have to exercise their citizenship.
Indeed.
And in the last election, only 54.2% of eligible voters in America decided it was worth voting.
I'm wondering how you felt about the activism of a person with whom you worked closely when you were in the Senate, Lindsey Graham.
Well, Lindsey and I partnered on one particularly important issue, which was climate change at the time. And then he backed off of that for various reasons. I was disappointed in what he said and in the tone and manner of his accusations during the hearings. I wish that there hadn't been that kind of divisiveness and accusatory confrontation. But that's an example of the degree to which pressures from the ideology police within the Republican caucus are having an impact today. It's all ideology, all politics, all the time. And that's part of the problem that we face right now in making things work in Washington.
I wonder how you felt about leadership from the Democrats.
Well, I was saying, just being candid about this and equal opportunity in my observation, I think that the Democratic leadership should have come forward earlier with a conversation, at least, between McConnell and the chairman of the committee, Senator Grassley, that talked about what they'd been presented with, so that there could have been some effort to have a common approach to dealing with a very sensitive and difficult issue, rather than have it come up at the very last minute in the way that it did. And I thought that was an unfortunate detriment to the legitimacy of the process.
You write in your memoir, Every Day is Extra, about how you felt regarding the swift vote Veterans for Truth campaign during your 2004 presidential run. Having experienced that so-called fake news, what is it like for you to see that kind of effort dominate the news today?
Well, it's a danger to our democracy, as I've just described, Diane. If we're not able to agree on what basic facts are, if people are going to argue there are alternative facts, that there's an alternative to 2 and 2 is 4 and 4 and 4 is 8, we're in trouble. There is no way we will build a consensus around any of the big decisions we have to make if people are offering alternative facts.
But then how should politicians confront it?
You have to confront it with hard work of going out and fighting for the truth, putting the truth out there without any fear, with just in a straightforward way, that ultimately, not immediately, but ultimately, I believe will penetrate and most Americans will come to share it. But I think it has to happen. You can't do it in a confrontational, negative way that insults people as you're doing it, or that it makes people feel you're calling them stupid, or you're attacking people because, for whatever qualitative reason you want to attach to it. You have to try to fight for the truth in a non-ideological, non-political way that people could actually buy into it and not feel threatened by it. It requires a fair number of people to change their point of view. For instance, on climate change, how you can be a climate denier today is obviously a reach, but people push it. And you've got to kind of get your facts out there in front of them and make the case in a way that doesn't just make people hibernate and dig deeper into a very bad place, a dark place.
The department that you ran as Secretary of State is a very different place now. Tell me your thoughts about the Iran deal and its dismantling.
Well, I think getting out of the Iran deal is an enormous strategic mistake. I think it makes the world more dangerous, not safer. I think it turns our back on a strategy that allowed us to keep Iran from having a nuclear weapon while they had to stay within the confines of the agreement, and it gave us the ability to get Russia, China, France, Germany, Britain, our partners in the agreement, to join us in putting pressure on Iran to behave better, to stop supporting Hezbollah, to stop supporting the Houthi in the war in Yemen, to stop its trafficking in weapons and its support for terrorism. But I think what's happened by just pulling out, we have now empowered the hardliners in Iran who doubted in us and in the deal the whole time and now have been proven correct in that. And we also have made it much more difficult to bring our friends, the French, German, British, Chinese, and others, to the table to hold Iran accountable for its other activities. So all in all, I think it's a mistake.
All right, and we're learning more about the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. What should President Trump's response be if indeed it is proven he did not walk out of that facility on his own 2 feet?
Well, if that's proven, and I emphasize that, if that is proven, it's a very egregious departure from any kind of behavior acceptable under any standard whatsoever. I mean, it's really something different than any of us have experienced. It would be very overt and brazen in its calculation, and I think it will merit a significant response. There are any number of options on what that might be, and I don't want to get specific ahead of an administration or ahead of the facts. But obviously, if that were to be the case, that is a serious moment.
What could it mean or should it mean for our relations with the Saudis?
Well, it's a serious problem, obviously, in terms of the confrontation between our values and a fellow who works for major American newspaper, a very respected journalist. It's a human being. I mean, anybody. You don't have to just work for a newspaper, but it raises the profile of it, obviously. I think people would be are deeply concerned about it. And again, you've got to get the facts, but if it were proven to be true, it's going to merit a significant response.
I would like to take you back to the early pages of your memoir. When you tell us as readers that you did not learn about your grandfather's suicide until you were in your teens, I wonder what kind of impact that had on you and whether you felt dismayed by having that information having been kept from you for all that time.
Well, you know, that's a very good question. And I think, yeah, I think the answer was I was sort of curious about the silence. But again, I guess on reflection, after talking to people, it's such a dramatic, horrible moment. And my dad was only 6 years old when it took place. So I'm sure he pressed it into the recesses and really didn't want to let me know or anybody let me know until I was older. I was, you know, as I say, 16 years old or so. And even then, you know, it's obviously it's jarring. You worry about, well, what happened? What was wrong? What was it that was going on that produced that? And it raised a lot of questions, but it didn't, you know, I guess we human beings are just naturally disposed sometimes with, you know, a little more time than others, but to kind of put things in their place. And I just put it in its place. I didn't know much. My grandmother had passed away, and I had nobody who really knew much of the story or was willing to talk about it. So I didn't know much about it.
It was shocking to me when I read it. How did you feel when you learned the truth?
Well, I was shocked. I was shocked by the truth. My grandfather died in a very violent act, took a gun to his head in a public facility, and I can't think of anything more violent and destructive in many ways. And I've often asked myself, you know, what the hell was he thinking? What was going on? I just don't have an answer to that. I can imagine, and, you know, you kind of go through different scenarios, but the fact is I don't know.
Over the course of your career, you dealt with the image of being an elite, something that the Democratic Party as a whole is facing, has been called by the President of the United States, that Democrats simply don't understand the problems of real people. What is it going to take for the Democrats to really help people to understand who and what they really are?
Well, I believe Democrats do understand it. I don't think necessarily have been as effective at making sure people understand that. But there is no doubt in my mind about the fraudulence of what is being presented now by this administration in terms of that concern. Goods and services are going to be more expensive for average people because of the tariffs the president is invoking. There's no question in my mind the tax bill is better by far for billionaires and millionaires than it is for the average person in this country. I mean, somebody getting, you know, a tiny percentage increase in their pay raise versus millions of dollars of a freebie is a far cry from understanding the problem of this country. And I think when you look at the health care insurance that's being taken away from people, when you look at what's happening to, you know, by and large, it's not the wealthy people who live next to the toxic waste site. And it's not the wealthy people who have the worst air quality because of the circumstances of where they can build their homes and where they live. But the diesel trucks go by, you know, through parts of major cities that leave our children during the summer suffering from environmentally induced asthma, which we spend $55 billion a year on. So I think there is a powerful, powerful case to be made for the ways in which this is the great hucksterism. It's the great con job. And people have been somehow persuaded that the president's fighting for them, when in fact he's feeding the trot of the same cesspool and swamp that has stolen the future from a lot of people over the past years. And it's Democrats who have fought to keep health care for people. It's Democrats who are fighting for the environmental regulations that will protect people, the air you breathe, the water you drink. And it's Democrats who are fighting for fair earning of wealth by virtue of the work you do, and you're able to pay for your family, send your kids to school, not be in interminable debt. That is a distinction. And I could go on, not going to go on now, but I tell you, there's no question in my mind that, you know, the facts clearly draw the distinction between what Donald Trump's fighting for in reality versus what the Democrats are fighting for.
As you and I are talking on this Thursday afternoon, the Dow, the stock market, has fallen more than 1,000 points in just 2 days. President Trump has said he knows better than the Fed how to handle money. Give me your thoughts.
Well, my first thought is that that's part of the great mislead, the misdirect, the con job of what the president's been saying and doing. Because the fact is, many of his businesses have gone bankrupt. American major banks wouldn't lend him a dime because they didn't trust him. And the fact is that his reputation for truly managing big money is not that great. He took $400 million left to him by his father, and he lost money. He'd be worth a hell of a lot more today if he just let that money ride the market than what he did. So the record is very clear about, that when he says that, it's just not true. Secondly, there's very clear reasons the market is reacting. The market is reacting to a number of different things. I'm sure it's reacting to what's happened with what's alleged to have happened with Khashoggi. I know it is reacting to the recent speech that declared a new policy towards China and to the increasing hostility between the United States and China. And then the market is reacting to interest rates that are, on the rise and to a sense of a slowdown in various parts of the global economy. So those are the biggies that I think the market's responding to. And I don't think, once again, Donald Trump is being candid with the American people.
What do you think needs to happen for Democrats to succeed in the midterms? And do you believe they will?
Well, I'm not a prognosticator, so I'm not going to get into predicting what's going to happen. I hope they will, because I think the alternative that is offered and the importance of having a check and a balance on the president is absolutely vital. But I think that we have an opportunity in the next 27 days to have a major course correction in the country. And I think people of common sense understand that it's important to have checks and balances. That's what the founding fathers always conceived of. That is what we're meant to have between the three branches of government. And our hope is that in this midterm election, there'll be a course correction that will allow us to require the parties to come together in order to make important things happen for the nation.
And one last question, which I'm sure you knew would come. Are you going to run for president in 2020?
Well, I hope it wouldn't come. I'm really not sitting around trying to decide whether to run for president. And I've said many times, nobody should be talking about 2020 right now, Diane. We need to be focused on 27 days from now. It genuinely is one of the most important midterm course correction opportunities we've had in this country for a long time. And my hope is that people will realize that one of the reasons we're having this horrible fight in America today is because only 54.2% of eligible voting Americans saw fit to come out and vote in 2016. So in 26 days, we have an opportunity to make up for that. When Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, the turnout was 62.3%. We should be doing better than that. So every vote does count.
and it's critical for citizens in our great country, in order to, you know, remain great and continue to do the things we've always done, we have to make our democracy work. And the best and only way to do that is to vote.
I said that that was the last question. However, I do want to ask you, how is your wife?
Well, thank you very much for asking that. She's doing terrifically. She's a wonderful fighter, as I think everybody knows. And she's, I would say, really in terrific shape. She's really doing well.
I'm glad to hear that. Secretary Kerry, thank you so much for being with us. Next time you're in Washington, drop by and see us.
Thank you, Diane, very much. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Urib-Lipker and Josephine Nayunai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.